The seas of action are very hard to understand. Therefore, one should know properly what action is, what forbidden action is, and what inaction is. One should understand the nature of karma, vikarma, and akarma, and one must act accordingly. This is the law of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The conditioned souls who have come to this material world for sense gratification are allowed to enjoy their senses under certain regulative principles. If they violate these regulations, they are judged and punished by Yamaraj. He brings them to the hellish planets and properly chastises them to bring them back to Krishna consciousness. By the influence of Maya, however, the conditioned souls remain infatuated with the mode of ignorance. Thus, in spite of repeated punishment by Yamaraj, they do not come to their senses, but continue to live within the material condition, committing sinful activities again and again. Om Agyana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dati Swapadantikam Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindubhya Evacha Patitanan Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So we're diving right into this description of the hellish planets, and there's quite a few things we can pick up here from the purport, what Prabhupada is mentioning. This introduction is giving us the clue that actually the problem that is responsible for conditioned souls having to experience this hellish situation is this false sense of independence that Prabhupada immediately quotes this verse, Prakrite kriyamanani guna karmani sarvasha ahankara vimudatma kartahamiti manyate. The bewildered spirit soul under the influence of the three modes of material nature thinks himself the doer of activities which are in actuality carried out by nature. The foolish person thinks he is independent of any law. He thinks there is no God and he can do whatever he likes. Thus he engages in different sinful activities. Therefore he has to face the hellish reactions. So what we're hearing is that the cause actually of one's requirement to experience such hellish situation is due to their association with the modes of nature. That simply by the influence of false ego, the soul is forced to take up activities under the jurisdiction of these three different modes. So his activities may either be under the mode of goodness, under the mode of passion, or under the mode of ignorance. The soul himself is actually helpless. We know from Bhagavad Gita that he's not the actual doer of his activities. Rather, he's being simply carried around by these different modes of nature. So the soul is actually aloof, but he's forced to act. He's active by nature. So the material atmosphere where sense gratification is the primary objective, as we heard, living entities come to this world to experience sense gratification. And they can either do it two ways. They can do it according to Krishna's system, according to the Vedic prescriptions, or they can do it haphazardly or independently. And if they do sense gratification according to the Vedas, then they can advance. They don't have to go to hell. But if they do it according to their own whims and speculations, then they do actually have to suffer very, as we'll hear about, more and more unbearable situations. So what we really want to, the point being highlighting is how we need to ourselves familiarize ourselves with the modes of nature and very carefully keep ourselves aloof from these lower modes of passion and ignorance. So part of what I wanted to just discuss a little is how this description of the hellish planets, a lot of things in the Bhagavatam we think, this is not real so related to my situation. Many parts of Bhagavatam, this is just, it's nice information. But we know that even as devotees, actually, there's always risk. There's always contamination in this world, and we're always very susceptible, actually, that if we're not very careful, we can also There's also particular statements given in the Shastra. Even devotees can end up in hell if they're not careful in the discharge of their duties. So because it is, this is an important part of the Bhagavad Gita, understanding how the Vedic system actually works, I thought I would just review how is it that simply by following the Vedic injunctions, one's freed from a life of misery. This is the whole idea, is that in the material world, the souls are actually, by nature, they're under these lower modes of nature. So then what is the means of elevation? How can they become uplifted? And the system that Krishna actually gives is by following one's duties in the Varnashram system, one naturally actually becomes elevated. So this is the means by which any individual, simply by adhering to the Vedic paradigm, he can progress ultimately towards self-realization. And that begins, of course, we understand through this Karmakanda section. So this is taken from Bhagavad Gita and also from Burijan Prabhu's Surrender Unto Me. We're familiar, but we'll just review it to better understand how this actually saves one from a life of suffering. In other words, to become situated under the protection of such a system, the Vedic system, one must agree to regulate his enjoyment by the descending authority of Vedic formulas. When following that system does not simply act as he desires, his mood of subservience to God's order in the form of the Vedas, even though his purpose is to attain sense pleasure, is purifying, for he is following Krishna's system. So the key is figuring out how we can understand our dependence on Krishna. This is the whole purpose, actually, that the conditioned soul needs to realize his dependence on the Lord, that he's not independent. We're in the material world because we're trying to be God. We think we're God, and we're trying to lord it over. So we need to come to grip with the reality that actually we're subservient to God in every circumstance of life. So by following Krishna's order in the form of the Vedas, one implicitly accepts the principle that he is not independent. Rather, his enjoyment depends on the satisfaction of higher authorities. And then we have this process of the Lord sends the generations of living beings to demigods with sacrifice, and therefore one can live happily if they offer, if they perform yajna, but if they don't, they're certainly actually considered a thief. A thief is punished by the state. The thieves who live within this world without repaying the demigods for the amenities they have used are punished by Yamaraj. So, failing to understand our dependence, how everything is actually Krishna's energy, that we can't simply take things for our own exploitative purposes. Actually, everything has to be offered in sacrifice. Otherwise, the court of Yamaraj is pending. That's the destination. Followers of the Vedic system, even though they have material desires, are not punished. Rather, they are elevated by their submission to the Vedic system. So here we can see Krishna's mercy. He understands how, you know, rascal the conditioned souls are. They've left the spiritual world to experience some type of seeming enjoyment, the illusion of some type of sense gratification that they think is going to give happiness. But Krishna is so kind that he says, okay, even you want to enjoy, fine, you can enjoy here, but just at least accept my authority, and then I'll elevate you. So if one refuses to even do that, even agree to Krishna's kind process of rectification, then one has to suffer the laws of nature. Just like there's the principles of correction in a state, there's laws in a school, if someone doesn't obey teacher, they have to. So all throughout our society, we see there's a cause and a reaction if one doesn't follow those laws. So it's natural in this, even the modern scientific, it's all based on laws. There's all these laws, right? So what happens if you don't follow the law? For as far as morality and living a pious life, there's obviously going to be, there has to be some consequence. Prabhupada says, whether the agnostics accept that or not, that's the fact, that's the reality. So then by not adhering to Krishna's merciful system of upliftment, then one is forced to be punished. So another point that's brought out in this one of these later texts in text 5, it's explained that actually due to the desire, let me see, Yeah, due to one's desire, because of ignorance, every living entity has been carried by various desires into thousands of different hellish planets. And this is actually text 3. So the desire is active. Now the problem is when that desire is influenced by these other modes of nature. We all have desires, we can't stop desire. But if our desire is not directed properly as a spiritual desire, or as at least the mode of goodness, then that desire becomes our enemy. That desire becomes the source of our suffering, actually unlimited miseries in the material world, because it's influenced by passion, fruitive activity, or ignorance. The opposite happens. We think what's good is actually bad for us. What we think is bad is actually good for us. So we need to be very careful as how on a moment-to-moment basis, our desires that are coming out, what are they being influenced by? Under what modes of nature are desires? To make sure that those are properly directed. And also the point to properly understand the different types of karma. Karma, akarma, and vikarma, Prabhupada mentions. Without carefully understanding and actually surrendering or accepting these different types of activities, Prabhupada says, one should understand the nature of karma, vikarma, and akarma, and one must act accordingly. This is the law of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, the laws of nature are very fine. They're very severe. There's not much. There's mercy in Krishna consciousness and the association of devotees, but the material nature is very rough. It's very strict, actually. You follow the principles and you can become elevated. If you don't follow them, you have to suffer the reactions. There's not a whole lot of room for mercy in that sense. Now, so what we want to understand actually how, what is the purpose of the system though? Because if even by going to the hellish planets, we're hearing that those who end up in these hellish planets, they may not even reform themselves. They're conditioned by these lower modes of ignorance. So Prabhupada explains, in spite of repeated punishment by Yamaraj, they don't come to their senses but continue to live in the material condition, committing sinful activities again and again. This is all by the influence of Maya. Conditioned souls remain infatuated. So we could ask them, what is the purpose of such a system where, for example, our modern prison system, people go, they get punished, they go to jail, but they come out and they do the same thing. And we know this is a discussion in Nectar of Instruction of atonement. What's the use of atonement if it doesn't actually change the propensity for sinful activity? So the idea is that these laws of nature, Krishna is just, actually. So we know in Bhagavad Gita also he explains of principles of administering justice, I am chastisement. Something like that. This is one of Krishna's qualities, actually, that he is making sure everyone gets their due. It's a quality of God. But this system of actually having to descend to the hellish planets to suffer the sinful reactions is not the ideal situation all for the living entities to be uplifted, but actually we can appreciate the role of the devotees, the role of the sadhus and guru, because they're the ones that are actually uplifting the souls to transcend material life altogether. The devotees are the ones by giving the shastra. Without this, we wouldn't even understand about the hellish planets. We would have no one. The devotees have come to actually share the knowledge and the process by which we can get free from this risk in this whole material world altogether. So our appreciation can even more so be increased by understanding their value for being the only means by which otherwise we're trapped in this cycle. Birth and death going down to the heavenly or hellish planets again and again. But by meeting the devotee then, he can speak to us. He can share transcendental knowledge with us. He can give us the holy name. And then these are the means by which the soul actually becomes rectified, by which he can give up his sinful proclivity, his propensity for sinful activity. So just the glorification of the position of devotees and the guru, scripture, all these aspects that make up our lives, as far as being the actual only means to deliver us from this situation. So, part of the importance of understanding the modes of nature is actually, Krishna explains throughout the Bhagavad Gita, to help free us actually from making, we would say aparad or offense, that understanding every living being is the soul. This is the first principle of Bhagavad Gita. And in order to progress spiritually, one has to give up committing offenses to Krishna. And the souls are part and parcel of Krishna. So jiva aparad, it's a form of Vishnu aparad, actually. So understanding the modes of nature helps free us from this tendency to criticize or to become envious, all these things of other living entities, because we understand they're under the modes of nature. They're simply under the modes of nature. It's not that one has to. It's not that one has to point fingers at so many different living entities and see how they're doing this wrong and this, but to actually understand how they're simply under the modes of nature. In other words, we discriminate. We understand what are proper activities and what are improper activities, but we don't actually blame the soul. The soul is a part and parcel of God. He's under the modes of nature. But rather, we want to understand how we can assist them, how we can serve them. This becomes an important principle. So I wanted to just explore that a little more and also perhaps understand how this discussion can relate to us also as devotees of the hellish planets. Now, some of us are familiar with the writings of Srila Vrindavan Das Thakur, and he also brings to light the results or the reactions of not properly engaging in devotional service. There's great benefit. There's the highest gain can be achieved by association with devotees, but also there's also the greatest risk coming in contact with the Lord's devotees who are most dear to him. So I thought I might just share a verse. This is from the Madhya Kanda of the Chaitanya Bhagavat, chapter 5, text 139. Just as a foolish person who worships the feet of a Brahmana and then beats him in the head goes to hell, one who worships the deity form of Lord Vishnu and then disrespects that same Lord who is situated in the hearts of all living entities also goes to hell. There's a purport commentaries on this. What to speak of being envious of Vaishnavas? If one causes pain to ordinary living entities, he is considered a fallen, low-class person. Even after worshiping Lord Vishnu, if a person gives trouble to other living entities, his worship becomes fruitless. Such a person suffers unlimited miseries. So these are very purifying verses to understand the real position of a Vaishnav. That in our, we're going out for preaching and so many different circumstances come up and we have material tendencies to just react in such a way that is not proper conduct or proper consciousness for a devotee. These type of things come out, especially in difficult circumstances, we're tested. But here we're hearing the actual nature of a devotee. If a person is knowingly or unknowingly envious of a Vaishnava, engaged in the non-duplicitous service of Lord Hari, his degradation is inevitable. Of this there is no doubt. Apart from this, if even persons claiming to be devotees of Vishnu are envious of ordinary living entities and give various troubles to them, they are actually far away from devotional service to Vishnu and are not fit to be called human beings. So the standard is not that I've become a devotee, so you know I can just do whatever and I can disregard other living entities, you know, all sorts of manifestations of that consciousness. But rather, by hearing from very advanced devotees, we understand actually the nature of devotees is the most compassion and respect for all living entities. This becomes a requirement to actually perceive Krishna, to be able to properly respect all of his parts and parcels. Their worship of Vishnu becomes the source of misery. Those endowed with an absence of jiva-doya, or compassion for other living entities, and yet proudly consider themselves servants of Lord Vishnu, achieve the threefold miseries, rather than the devotional service of the Lord. So this is, as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, the followers of Mahaprabhu and Lord Nityananda, this is really the mood of compassion for others, and in whatever activities we're doing, to be very careful to guard against this enviousness that can come out to other living entities, or to be unsympathetic, or to not have compassion, seeing the plight of others, even in what we're hearing about the fifth canto, that the real devotee is greatly pained by these descriptions of hearing the suffering that is coming. Now, we can, this will kind of escalate in severity a little bit, of just these descriptions for caution, for our own protection, actually. The next text, 145. It is 100 times more sinful to blaspheme a Vaishnava than to be envious of ordinary living entities. So he talked about this problem of envy towards other living. Now, also, as we mentioned, in the association of devotees, then also we have great risk. And here it's explained, to blaspheme a Vaishnava, this is 100 times even worse. Lord Vishnu is situated in the heart of every human being. Although Vaishnavas appear to be ordinary human beings, they are always situated as Vaishnavas due to their inclination towards the service of Lord Vishnu, residing in their hearts. Ordinary human beings are bereft of the service of Vishnu and are situated in the modes of passion and ignorance, whereas Vaishnavas are fully saturated with the mode of goodness and are constantly engaged in the service of Vishnu. So if one carefully considers the differences that exist between them, then it is understood that by envying a Vaishnava engaged in the service of Vishnu, one incurs 100 times more sins or offenses than by envying an ordinary living entity. In Srimad Bhagavatam 4.4.13 it is stated, it is not wonderful for persons who have accepted the transient material body as the self to always engage in deriding great souls. Such envy on the part of materialistic persons is very good, because that is the way they fall down. They are diminished by the dust of the feet of great personalities. So the bodily identification actually is a source of this envious or deriding great personalities. The bodily concept of life, we know Rupa Goswami carefully warns that actually the pure devotees should never be considered from a materialistic point of view. This is the cause of disrespect towards saintly personalities. My dear King, if one derides an exalted devotee, he loses the results of his pious activities, his opulence, his reputation, and his sons. Vaishnavas are all great souls. Whoever blasphemes them falls down to the hell known as Maharavara. He is also accompanied by his four fathers. Whoever kills or blasphemes a Vaishnav, whoever is envious of or angry with a Vaishnav, and whoever does not offer obeisances or feel joy upon seeing a Vaishnav certainly falls into a hellish condition. O ruler of the world, one who first respects a Vaishnav and then later insults him is vanquished along with his family. It is further said, if one gives pain to Vaishnavas, then the results of his pious activities like high birth and caste are all destroyed. So this is, I mean, there's descriptions of these planets even, you know, we can look that up later to see which planets are being described, but these penalties, even for one who worships Lord Vishnu, even for practicing devotee, if one succumbs to deriding or blaspheming, criticizing the devotees, or what to speak of the most elevated saintly personalities, then actually this type of descriptions are actually applicable. The most sinful people who criticize great Vaishnavas are subjected by Yamaraj to the severe punishment of being sliced in pieces by very sharp saws. Lord Hari, the supersoul of the entire universe, is never pleased with the miscreant who insults a Vaishnava, even if he has worshipped Vishnu for hundreds of births. And in the Brahma Vivarta Purana, those who criticize Lord Rishikesha and his devotees lose all the benefits accrued in 100 pious births. Such sinners rot in the Kumbhipaka hell and are eaten by hordes of worms for as long as the sun and moon exist. If one sees a person who blasphemes Lord Vishnu and his devotees, then the results of all his pious activities are lost. When learned persons see such non-Vaishnavas, they purify themselves by taking bath in the Ganges and looking at the sun. So this is just kind of perhaps bringing the discussion a little closer as far as the risk that's also for devotees when we hear these descriptions, and understanding the great fortune that we have by having this knowledge, how the devotees have mercifully given this to us. So at least minimum, we should never, and we should always be on careful guard. Even in friendly dealings and things, the tendency of our material nature comes out. Unfortunately, that tendency is a lot of selfishness and envy. So in devotee association, that tendency can come out, and that can be a great cause of concern. And if not properly dealt with, actually, these things are happening in today's world. You know, the internet, all these things, people are actually committing such aparad that This is what's being described, actually, the result. So just, as always, purifying to hear about the glory of the Lord's devotees and the risks of not properly interacting with him or letting our material tendencies go unchecked. So maybe I'll just pause there for now. Thanks for your attention. Just a few thoughts as we begin this section. Are there any questions or comments?
Thank you very much. It was very scary.
This is a scary section.
So, Prabhu, every time, we create offenses in the mind also to the devotees. We try to be a leader. Internally, we try to make, why he is speaking? I am a speaker. He doesn't know anything. Internally, he feels that he don't even listen to anyone. He feels that he is only the person and he is only the speaker.
Mm.
He tried to behave good in front of the seniors to get his impression that, okay, I am. He tried to behave good with the juniors because he wanted to prove himself idle. But with the same level, or maybe the person getting, you know, when you put in the pan, weighing balance, sometimes that person is up, sometimes that person is down. Mm. It's try to think like that.
Yeah.
So in that situation, the tendency comes that he wants to, why is he speaking? He's in the second pan. He should be always over here. So how to judge that situation? And we can see that person is doing like that, but we can't say anything at that time.
So how to avoid mentally trying to distinguish and in mental offenses?
Yes.
This is what we're doing. We hear about the glories of the devotees. We really need to hear about the glories. We don't know what devotees are. We don't understand the position of devotees in Krishna consciousness. Therefore, we're taking everything very lightly, and we're not taking these warnings to heart. And in our interactions, immediately we hear some nice things, but the next few minutes, suddenly we're doing the same thing again. There was a nice verse also in this section, but I didn't pull it out. But understanding how rare the devotee is amongst many, many millions of materialistic people. You know, there's a few that are engaged in karma yoga, or they're trying to elevate themselves. Amongst many, many thousands of those, there's maybe one that's a gyani, or they're cultivating spiritual knowledge. Among many, many thousands of gyanis, there may be one who's actually on a spiritual platform. And among those who are actually liberated or on the spiritual platform, out of many, many thousands or even millions, maybe one is a devotee. You just take a look at Chicago, how many millions of people there are here, how many people are here in the temple. So these are not ordinary people. These are not regular people that we're associating with. So we really need to keep that in mind and constantly remind ourselves, because we may say, oh, that's nice, and then just go. But no, we need to constantly keep that in mind. And these are ways to actually avoid Vaishnava aparadha, that if you don't, there's these six different types of offenses to a Vaishnava: to kill, to blaspheme, to not be happy upon seeing them, to become angry, to not offer obeisances like that. So also, we need to implement these teachings. We need to apply what we're hearing and strive to develop loving relationships. If there's love amongst the devotees, that's a natural protection. This is the key. If we develop genuine attraction with the devotees and sincere regard for them, then there's not going to be the tendency. But when there's a little kind of scuffle, I don't get along with you, immediately we see this demoniac nature comes in, right? And then we're hearing the result, how much more sinful it is to deride or be envious of a Vaishnav than even an ordinary living entity. So 100 times more than ordinary living entities, we become envious, you know? We go on Sankirtan, oh, this person talked to me the wrong way, they didn't take a book, why are these foolish mudhas? You know, we're not saying that out of compassion, we're saying that out of envy. So then when we become devotees, just appreciating their position, that's one thing. Jai Prabhu, please.
saying, Rupesh speaks about the karma yogi, but he's speaking about the karma yogi, but he speaks about the practitioner mentally renouncing the actions of his gross and subtle body. So because we are on the intentional of his true nature, our gross and subtle bodies are automatically carrying on various activities which may be simple or offensive nature in terms of our politics. But he speaks about the karma controlling his nature and mentally renouncing those actions.
This is really nice, thanks. When he's speaking, also someone can give the mic just so they can hear. Now to explore a little more, so we can renounce these, this becomes an important part of getting off the bodily and mental platform, being able to be detached from those interactions. So how does that then, how does that evolve from the point of just, okay, over time I'm neglecting, I'm ignoring. How does that then progress into actually the positive cultivation of the real mind? That's what we want, right?
That's our process. We want to develop ruchi so that our ruchi will control everything. Just like in material existence, our taste for sense objects controls all of our movement. So we want to reverse the process so that our taste controls all our movement in spiritual life, as Krishna also discusses in the Bhagavad Gita and the Paranjastanavarta verse. So in the meantime, we're struggling along, mentally renouncing the gross and subtle actions, and simultaneously chanting Hare Krishna, and increasing qualitatively and quantitatively our hearing and chanting, so that we actually get a taste for it, and then our taste can control the movement of our mind and senses, and we don't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah, thank you very much. Anything else? Someone like to add a question? Okay, Himanshu.
What's the difference between renouncing the activity and dovetailing it? Like, I'm thinking of an example from Nectar of Instruction, where Prabhupada says, if one has a tendency to be angry, then one should direct that anger towards the non-devotees. So how do we, you know what I'm saying? How can you clarify that a little bit?
No, I'm just, the liberation is different, that's all. So in chapter 5, he's speaking about a karma yogi who is engaged in activity and according to his nature. But Krishna in this section of the Gita is describing his inner renunciation. And Krishna's approving of him above the Jnana yogi who doesn't engage in any activity whatsoever. Krishna's glorifying the karma yogi above him, saying that he's also engaged in activities according to his nature, which you might call dovetailing in ISKCON. But his inner renunciation, that's what's being described in that section of Bhagavad Gita. So his deliberation has changed. Before, we would engage in activities according to our nature, led by kama. Now we're engaged in the same activities according to our nature, led by desire for relationship with the Absolute in the context of Bhakti Yoga. Okay. The deliberation has changed, so that's how one is doing it. Of course, it's a gradual improvement. In the beginning, you might be like absorbed in activity and kind of lose sight of Krishna. So it's a practice until we develop ruchi.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
It's also interesting to know that Krishna thinks the karma yogi who is internally renouncing is higher than a jnana yogi. Because generally we hear that it's you perfect the karma yoga process and then you
well, come to chapter 3. Chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita is about the karma yogi who's trying to develop jnana.
Chapter 5
is about the jnana yogi who's developed jnana. So they're not it's not the same discussion. Both chapters are called karma yoga, but the karma yogi in chapter 5 is the one who's already developed Gyan. So he has Gyan like the Gyani in chapter 4, but he's engaged in activities, and Krishna's putting that Gyan, he's putting him in an improved position for several reasons. One reason Krishna says is that this person is loved by everyone, sarva-bhutatma, bhutatma, which is interesting, because he's engaged in activities that they can also relate to, but he has inner wisdom. So he doesn't try to exploit living into these. Krishna describes his intelligence is fixed, his mind is controlled, his senses don't exploit.
Non-envious.
So he's loved by everyone. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Gyanis usually aren't appreciated by anyone. They usually thought of as bums or parasites, especially in the modern day. So Krishna says this karma yogi who is engaged, he's loved by everyone because he has the wisdom of a saintly person, but he's also engaged in activities that people can actually relate to. Mm-hmm. So Krishna's this way Krishna's gradually bringing us to devotion, which it's quite similar, except that in context, karma yogis aren't exactly aiming for bhakti directly.
So there's two types of karma yogis, one without jnana and one with
jnana.
Thank you.
Unless we don't have a feeling of unless we don't curb that feeling of competition among the devotees, we can't have a direct compassion for other people. We talk of mudas and all that things, that external thing, that's maybe joking. But unless we have that feeling of real humbleness, we can't have compassion for other people. Am I right or wrong?
This is a comment. Thank you.
There's a saying that Dharanara Maharaj said that you cannot give love unless you receive love. So that was his response to his comment. So I think it is true. We make all the external criticism, but deep inside our heart, we're really finding fault with materialistic people. So until we actually receive love, which is coming from Krishna and his devotees, then we can actually give compassion to others. Thank you.
Love is so ambiguous in the modern day, no one knows what the hell it means actually. You know, you got to give love in order to receive it.
It's material.
Everyone's going to start speculating according to their own conditioning what that actually means. We need the ground of Brahma-Bhuta realization to really see the soul. As Prabhupada says in Isha Upanishad, that the Brahma-Bhuta realized, so he's not misled by material bodies, but attracted to the spirit soul within. Which I always just love that simple statement. Because we are often misled by the gross and subtle bodies of conditioned souls.
Very often. But subtle too.
Especially the subtle body. Yeah, they're rude, they got attitude problem, and so on. But Brahma-Bhuta, Prabhupada describes in Isha Upanishad beautifully, that they're attracted by the spirit soul within. So we need at least that ground of of realization to really be deeply compassionate towards the souls, as opposed to some material reflection of
material
the real
adjustment
thing, and just, you know, imposing the idea of love according to my conditioned understanding. You know, so when Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes in one essay about Preeti, he said even the word love just creates a good feeling in the heart. He says it's just nice to say it, you know, Preeti, love, it's just nice to say. But we are all understanding according to conditioned life. And therefore, we have to qualify it. In order to give love, you have to receive love, but you really have to qualify the giving. Has to be, the substantial giving is from the ground of Brahma-Bhuta realization. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's only a matter of time before the material bodies distract you.
Thank you very much. This is really, I'm not cutting you off, I'm just really appreciating that. This is very critical for love. What is love? What is the... No, there's no love. Otherwise, it's just a material sandwich. You know, I love my hamburgers, and I also love my house, and I love you too, honey. And I love everyone. No, that means you don't love anyone. So if it's all it's all on the material platform, how can there be love? It's going to be here one day, next day it's gone. Divorces, all this.
Sometimes I say there's no substitute for actually advancing in Christian consciousness. It's not a matter of an acronym that's going to save you at the last moment or some cheap understanding of Christian consciousness that gives a bubbly feeling inside the heart. But one has to just actually become spiritually elevated. At least minimally, Brahman Bhuta realization has to come up. Otherwise, it'll be hard.
Yeah, I'm appreciating the point of this higher taste, that until we get that experience of Krishna's love for us in a genuine sense, then we are still going to be attracted to finding, you know, the fly. He seeks happiness where the sores are. So then our mind, unless we get the taste of our relationship with Krishna, then we actually take pleasure in things like criticism and things like that, because we don't have the higher taste. So we're like, oh, this looks nice, you know, big, juicy, you know, something gross. But the devotee, he's oh, my relationship with Krishna is so wonderful that, you know, seeing others as his part and parcel, this is the real bliss, this is the real happiness. Why? So, thanks a lot. Anything else? Okay, Jai. Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki. Sri Prabhupada Ki. Go permanently.
Thank you. And that, then, because